Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you fascinating stories from China. And what could be more fascinating than the discovery of China's mysterious terracotta army? 50 years on, we hear from the amazing archaeologists who first dug them up, plus the story of a forgotten hero whose invention helped millions of Chinese citizens learn to read and write. And Wham! How one of Britain's biggest pop groups became the first Western act to play in China. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 21st of March, these are our main stories. Women fleeing Sudan's civil war in the Darfur region have told the BBC that rape is being used to target the country's black African population. French regulators are imposing a fine on Google of more than $270 million for violating intellectual property rules. The headquarters of the Spanish Football Federation have been raided by police as part of a corruption investigation. Also in this podcast...
First, I go in with a cleanser and then I do a serum next.
Yes, I do think there's a problem with young people using older skincare products.
We look at why an age limit is being imposed on retinol products being sold in Sweden. Since April last year, Sudan has been torn apart by fighting between the country's military and their former allies, a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces. There have been harrowing stories of the violence experienced by women in the conflict. Those affected have spoken of how rape is used as a weapon of revenge against some members of the country's black African community. The UN says there are reports that the RSF, whose origins lie in Arab militia groups, has employed gender-based violence to subjugate, terrorise, break and punish women and girls. From Adre on the Chad-Sudan border, Mercy Juma has this report. Some people may find it distressing.
Amina tightens her coloured hijab around her oval face before throwing the loose ends over her shoulders. I say hello. She responds, never raising her eyes to look at me. A day before we met, the 19-year-old refugee from the Darfur region of Sudan found out that she is pregnant. She is here today to begin an abortion, desperately hoping her family never find out.
The incident happened in Sudan. I'm not married. I had never been with a man, except for the incident that happened. I didn't tell anyone. I don't think anyone knows. I just came to see a doctor because I didn't have my period for 2 months and I have pain in my abdomen.
Amina, whose name we have changed, is one of a huge number who have been raped or sexually assaulted during the conflict in Sudan. She is seeking help at a Médecins Sans Frontières clinic at the Adre refugee camp, just over the border in neighbouring Chad.
The militia caught me along with my aunt and cousins. They escaped, but I was kept for a whole day. One raped me many times before I managed to escape.
Sexual violence is a huge problem, but official figures are low because many women and girls do not speak out for fear of victimization. In response, many voluntary groups have sprung up in the refugee camps supporting the women who have been affected. It is midday. In a makeshift hut just outside the camp, a group of about 30 women and girls converge. A tray with tiny cups of tea and coffee is passed around. There are some dried dates, dried fruits, and nuts too. Zahra, a social worker and a refugee from Sudan, brings women who have been abused together.
The women have gone through many difficulties. They lost everything they have, and some also wanted to kill themselves. So it is very difficult. But we try and help them, giving them psychological support.
As the women share their experiences of both physical and sexual violence, tears flow freely in the room. Mariamu, not her real name, sobs so hard as she recounts to us her ordeal. Before the war, she studied accounting at university. She was attacked and raped by armed men in her home in Sudan. When she called for help, they fired a bullet inches away from her mother as she tried to come into the room to stop what was happening.
After that, I could not walk. My mom took some stuff from the house and we left with my grandmother. People were running, but we could not because my grandmother cannot run. I was also bleeding. We managed to flee, but I'm not feeling okay. I'm not happy. I'm really traumatized. They are doing that because they are trying to spoil our dignity, because they are taking us as their enemies.
Many times, Mariamu has wished she was dead. It is in gatherings like these ones that she gets some solace and is reminded that she is not alone.
For days and days, I've been saying to myself, why am I living? Why am I living? But Zahara talks to me and says, what happened to you happened to a lot of people. You must be strong and positive.
While attacks on women have been carried out by the Sudanese army, the UN says over 80% have been committed by the Rapid Support Forces and its allies. One prominent RSF member revealed his attitude towards women in a video posted on social media, saying, if we rape your daughter or your girl, it's an eye for an eye. This is our country, and this is our right, and we took it. 20 years ago, the UN says 300,000 members of the Black African community were killed in the Darfur region amidst accusations of genocide. Zahra says Black African women are being targeted in the current conflict.
This is revenge, because the Arab militias targeted a particular group, the Masalit, because of a history of old problems. They are doing this to the women because rape leaves an impact on society and the family.
The Rapid Support Forces told us the majority of accusations against it are untrue, but its troops are held accountable when incidents occur. Ordinary women are paying the price for the brutality which has been unleashed by the conflict in Sudan. With no end in sight, there could be many women suffering in silence.
That report by Mercy Juma on the Chad-Sudan border. It's the centrepiece of China's multi-billion dollar investment in Pakistan. But on Wednesday, the deep sea port of Gwadar in the southwestern province of Balochistan was stormed by militants who attacked with grenades, rocket launchers and Kalashnikovs, according to the authorities. Security forces at the port complex fought back, reportedly killing 8 gunmen. A Baloch separatist group said it carried out the attack. We got more details from our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis.
We are getting most of our information from the officials on the ground in Balochistan. Now, according to them, some armed militants arrived at the port of Gwadar with guns, with bombs. They stormed the complex, and it seems that they have targeted the area just outside the port, which is where the government departments are based, including intelligence agencies and paramilitary forces as well. And according to the government officials, they detonated a number of bombs. We've also heard from several sources that were close on the ground that said that they heard explosions. And then they began shooting as well. Now, according to the government officials, they say that 8 militants were killed during the process of trying to stop this attack. We've also heard that there were at least one soldier, Pakistani soldier, that was killed while trying to defend this area as well. But it's possible that there might be more. We're still waiting for further details about the exact number.
And it's believed that separatists are behind the attack. In fact, I think there's been a claim by the separatist group, the Baloch Liberation Army.
Yes. So the Baloch Liberation Army have claimed it. This is one of the most prominent of the separatist groups in Balochistan. Now, the area that this is in is particularly important. This is a deep sea port, the port of Gwadar, on the Arabian Sea. It is thought of as the gateway to the China-Pakistan economic corridor, part of China's Belt and Road infrastructure project. And China has poured large amounts of money into Pakistan, particularly in this area, in the province of Balochistan, despite the fact that there has been decades-long separatist insurgency in the area, the Baluch nationals wanting to have either a sort of independent separate state or just more autonomy over what happens inside Baluchistan. And so that has always been ongoing. And now there is a large amount of Chinese investment. Over the course of the last few years, there have been attacks by the BLA, by the Baluch Liberation Army, on both Chinese interests and also Pakistani interests in the region. According to the BLA, they say that the reason they did this, they were attacking the Pakistan intelligence agency's offices. And in particular, a lot of these separatist groups are trying to fight, they say, for a larger share in the wealth from the mines, the minerals that are mined in this area, that they want to have more of that money coming back into the region.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he has approved the operational plans for a ground offensive in the city of Rafah in southern Gaza. This is despite President Biden repeatedly urging Israel to call off an assault on the area where 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen, told us more.
Received a credible plan from the Israelis about the evacuation of the civilians. There are about 1.5 million thought to be sheltering in Rafah, more than half of the entire population of Gaza. And that is why there are these dire warnings of what could happen if the Israeli military does indeed go into Rafah. And today, Benjamin Netanyahu said he had approved the operational plans for the incursion into Rafah and that soon he would approve the evacuation plans. But he said it would take some time for the incursion to begin because, of course, the evacuation would have to go first. Now, this is all very much at the centre of the acrimonious relationship at the moment, increasingly so, between the Israeli government and the Biden administration. The two leaders spoke a couple of days ago for the first time in more than a month, and President Biden said that he told Benjamin Netanyahu that the incursion into Rafah would be a mistake. Now, it's likely to be at the centre of talks also on Friday when Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, comes to Israel on a previously unscheduled leg of his Middle East tour. Was that a snub to Israel? We don't know. But I mean, clearly the two governments are at loggerheads over Rafah and on several other parts of the war. And they will discuss it all on Friday during those talks.
Mark Lowen. French regulators say they will fine Google more than $270 million for violating intellectual property rules. This concerns breaches of compensation agreements made to news publishers for reproducing their content. Alice Adley reports.
France's competition authority said Google failed to respect commitments made 3 years ago to negotiate fairly with French news organisations on how much to compensate them for using their content. The regulator also found that Google used material to train its AI chatbot, Bard, since renamed Gemini, without notifying the publishers. Google says the fine is disproportionate. Google and other tech giants have been accused of making billions from news without sharing the revenue with the people who gather it.
Alice Adley. The Spanish Football Federation is in the news, but yet again it's for all the wrong reasons. Its headquarters in Madrid have been raided by police as part of a corruption investigation. Not only that, but the home of the federation's former president, Luis Rubiales, was also searched, along with a number of other locations. Several people have reportedly been arrested. Our Madrid correspondent, Guy Hedgeco, told us more about the raids.
What we know is that these raids were all linked to an investigation that is taking place into contracts that were signed between the Football Federation several years ago and a company called Cosmos, which is owned by a former Spanish international player, Gerard Piqué. And those contracts, they sought to move the Super Cup football competition from Spain to be played in Saudi Arabia. And the authorities believe that there was some kind of wrongdoing linked to those contracts. And they are investigating these contracts for alleged money laundering and corruption.
And it's interesting that the home of Luis Rubiales has been raided because he was caught up in another scandal last year.
Yes, in August of last year, just after Spain won the Women's World Cup final down in Australia, the women's team was celebrating their World Cup win. And to celebrate, Mr. Rubiales kissed one of the players on the lips, Jenny Hermoso. That triggered a massive backlash here in Spain, which led to Mr. Rubiales losing his job. And it also led to him being investigated for sexual assault. And he's going to go on trial for sexual assault because of the kiss that he gave Jenni Hermoso. So I think the fact that he is linked to this investigation only adds to his status as a very controversial figure in Spanish sport.
Guy Hedgeco. Now to a lakeside villa which is on sale for $90 million, but with no bidders. The villa is in Myanmar, and it's where the detained pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi lived and campaigned for many years, including 15 years while under house arrest. Jonathan Head is a BBC Southeast Asia correspondent. He told Nuala McGovern more about the house's long history.
It's known to everybody in Myanmar as No. 54 University Avenue, because it is the place from which Aung San Suu Kyi ran her campaign for democracy over many, many years, largely because she was confined for 15 years under house arrest there, couldn't leave, led a very quiet and isolated existence. And then in the brief periods when they did allow her freedom, she would then give speeches. I mean, from the front gate, people would come and fill the road up. It's very much associated with her. The house itself, it's a rather grand colonial villa, was given to Aung San Suu Kyi's mother back in 1953. The family had a pretty traumatic time because, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi's father, the founding father of the independence movement, was assassinated when she was only 2 years old in 1947, just before the country became independent. He was set to be its first leader. And then in 1952, her older brother drowned in a swimming pool in their then house in another part of what was then Rangoon. And so in 1953, the government donated this villa and the land by the lake to her mother, who was a highly respected figure. She went on to be an ambassador to India. And Aung San Suu Kyi and her surviving brother grew up there, although Aung San Suu Kyi spent quite a lot of time overseas. And in fact, she was out of the country through the 1960s and 70s studying, getting work experience, getting married. She married, of course, the British academic Michael Arris. And she used to go back for visits, but she didn't end up living back there until the fateful return in 1988, when she came back to look after her mother, who was ailing and would die that year, and got caught up in the first big anti-military movement, a huge uprising against the military that was put down very savagely. And she found herself leading, because of her famous provenance, her father, leading this movement, and founded the National League for Democracy, her party, and ran it from her house as well. So the house is totally wrapped up with her and with the history of Myanmar's struggle for democracy, a very powerful symbol, and indeed that's why many of Aung San Suu Kyi's supporters believe that these constant attempts have been made by her estranged brother, they believe with military backing, to try to take the house from her.
And to sell it. So it went on auction, but nobody has bid for it, but I couldn't believe the price. $90 million.
$90 million, most people think, is an absurd price, particularly now with the country mired in civil war, its economy near collapse. No one would pay that price rationally for that land. So you kind of wonder what's going on here, because the auction itself was also rather shoddily organised. The court officials who'd ordered its sale just showed up in front of the house this morning, and in front of the small gathering of journalists, there aren't many journalists left in Myanmar, they basically just said, right, anyone bid $90 million for this house? They did it three times, they banged a little gong, and they said, all right, no bids, we're postponing it. It's almost as though they weren't really trying to do it. Of course, it's fiercely opposed, the sale of the house. A lot of people are very angry about it. The movement that represents the ousted government that Aung San Suu Kyi led, the National Unity Government that's been fighting the military, has declared it a historic monument and says that any forced sale will be illegal. And remember that the country is in such a febrile state at the moment. There have been a number of bomb attacks in Yangon. There are movements fighting the military all across the country. So anybody who buys it might find themselves being targeted by anti-military campaigners as well, which might have been a strong disincentive to show up and start bidding for it, even if you wanted to pay that much money for it.
Jonathan Head. Still to come.
I just thought I'd ordered 8 Easter eggs, and then the lorry pulls up and we have a lorry full of Easter eggs. And yeah, I felt pretty stupid pretty quickly.
So what does a shopkeeper on a small Scottish island do when he has more Easter eggs in stock than the number of residents?
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. My award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, collecting letters from listeners from all over the world, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. And I'm joined by some very special guests, sharing their experiences and words of wisdom too. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcast.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you fascinating stories from China. And what could be more fascinating than the discovery of China's mysterious terracotta army? 50 years on, we hear from the amazing archaeologists who first dug them up, plus the story of a forgotten hero whose invention helped millions of Chinese citizens learn to read and write. And Wham! How one of Britain's biggest pop groups became the first Western act to play in China. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Senegal is finally holding presidential elections this coming Sunday. They were initially scheduled for the 25th of February, but President Macky Sall tried to postpone them indefinitely. That attempt ended in failure, sparking some of the most violent protests that this relatively stable nation has seen in recent times. President Sall has been speaking to our colleague, Wahiga Mawawa, who asked him if he wanted to apologise for the chaos he caused back in February by postponing the elections.
No.
I don't have to apologise because I didn't do anything wrong.
Do you pledge to the people of Senegal that on the 2nd of April, as head of state, you will step away from office, you will retire?
Of course.
On April 2nd, I'm leaving because that is the end of my mandate and I do not intend to stay. I hope that all this will go well and that the president-elect will take office to continue the work that was done by his predecessors.
What's your message to opposition candidates, some of whom feel that you have curtailed their campaigns? And I'll give you an example. When you were trying to unseat the former president, Abdoulaye Wade, you had the room to campaign. You had the room to compete then as a candidate, Mr. President. But your political opponents, at least three that I can mention, haven't seemed to enjoy the same rights over the last 4 years. I'm not also talking about Khalifa Sall, who looked quite strong also about 4 years ago and then faced a slew of legal wars. Is it coincidental that when a politician challenges Macky Sall, that suddenly they get into trouble with the law?
They are not challenging Macky Sall. No, ils ne sont pas en competition.
They are not in competition with me. For a very long time, at least since July, I was not a candidate for another term. Nevertheless, it is not because you are a politician that you should not answer for your actions before the law. If they had followed me, there would have been a process where all the actors were candidates. If we had postponed the elections to June, we would have had the possibility of having amnesty, which would have given them back a certain number of rights. So that Sonko would have been a candidate, Karim Wad would have been a candidate, as well as all the others. So if we didn't have the time we needed to campaign, it's not my fault.
When you look at the headlines in different media outlets over the last 3-4 months regarding Senegal, it's been about this beacon of democracy, this real pillar in the region that seems to have degenerated, that looked quite fragile as compared to how it was viewed before. Would you take personal responsibility as the head of state for what we've seen coming out of this region and out of this country over the last 3 months?
We still have to put into perspective the judgments we make about Senegal, its democracy, and its president. In the progress of states, there comes times where there are crises, and it is these crises which strengthen democracy. And I think that this crisis has shown that we have solid institutions, and more than ever, our democracy is set in stone.
Notre démocratie est inscrite dans le marbre.
President Macky Sall of Senegal. The former international footballer, Robinho, has been told by a court in his native Brazil that he will go to prison there to serve a 9-year sentence for rape. The sentence was imposed in Italy, where Robinho had been convicted for the gang rape of an Albanian woman. But after failing to get him extradited, Italy had asked that he serve his time in Brazil. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, told us more about the case.
Well, it happened in 2013. Robinho at the time was a big international star. He was a big Brazilian football team star, had played for Manchester City and was playing for Milan, for AC Milan. And this girl went to a VIP area in this nightclub, and she was basically encircled by Robinho and five of his friends and raped several times. He lost the first trial in 2017, appealed, and eventually he left Italy before the final appeal, knowing, fully aware, that the Brazilian constitution bans the extradition of any of its nationals unless it's for drug trafficking offences. And the interesting thing, the sad thing, is that four of his friends left the country immediately. They were never served and they were never tried. And him and his other friends were tried but left Italy before the sentence came, the final conviction, and they haven't served any time in prison so far.
So a lot of people very angry about that, but there's also been a lot of outrage over the details that have emerged of this case.
Yes, because the audios of Robinho and his friends discussing, joking about this case, awful comments, saying, for example, that she was an Albanese migrant, no one would believe her, that she was too drunk and she wouldn't be credible. All that was released in Brazilian media last year, and it caused a complete outrage. And I think that's why the court, the High Court in Brasilia, decided to take this decision, which is quite unusual, to get him to serve his prison sentence in Brazil. And they also ruled that he will have to serve it behind bars. There was a debate whether it's going to be a house arrest or not.
But he could still appeal.
He can appeal to the Supreme Court, but I would say that from what I heard in the trial, he has very little chance of getting, we don't know, but he has little chance of getting that successful, because there's an outrage in the country, and the judges said that the evidence is quite overwhelming, and it comes from Italy, where the justice system is quite reliable.
Leonardo Rocha. Now, you may have come across a teenage craze for using strong anti-aging products, possibly by following so-called skinfluencers on social media platforms. Creams, serums and face masks are all over TikTok or Instagram. But after seeing an increase in children using such products, Swedish pharmacies have announced they're imposing an age limit of 18 years. Stephanie Zacharyson reports.
You may have heard of retinol, a type of vitamin A, or salicylic acid, enzyme peeling, or other types of skincare products that have become increasingly popular in the last couple of years. They're all promising younger-looking skin, clearer, plumper, smoother, with fewer wrinkles. But there have been warnings that more and more young people are using such products, despite them potentially being way too strong for their skin. These teenagers told the BBC what they thought about it.
First, I go in with a cleanser and then I do a serum next.
Yes, I do think there's a problem with young people using older skincare products.
I know skincare, there's like quite a few acids that aren't really good for young people.
I found out about them from like TikTok and that type of stuff.
A leading pharmacy chain in Sweden, Apoteket Hjärtat, has decided to implement an age limit on what they're calling advanced skincare products. Younger people will still be able to buy them if, for example, they have a medical reason or if a parent comes with them to the shop. Their head pharmacist, Annika Svedberg, told Swedish Radio why they were introducing restrictions.
Everyone selling these products should take responsibility. So we're hoping that we're just the first of many companies and that others will follow our lead.
Last year, the EU imposed limits on the strength of some ingredients, such as retinol, in over-the-counter products. And recently, the British Association for Dermatologists warned that using certain products could leave children with skin problems. In Sweden, another pharmacy also said they would now add an age limit. And some cosmetic stores are considering similar rules. One of them said they'd had children as young as 7 coming in, asking to buy skincare products with anti-aging properties.
Stephanie Zacharyson. Finally, to Scotland, where a mix-up with an order has left a shop owner on the small Orkney island of Sandy with egg on his face, as he ended up with more chocolate Easter eggs in stock than there are people living on the island. He's had to come up with novel ways of getting rid of them all, including helping the local lifeboat charity, the RNLI. Adam Porter explains.
Around 500 people live on Sanday, so Dan David put in an order for 80 Easter eggs for Sinclair General Store. It turned out he'd ordered 80 cases. That's a whopping 720 eggs.
I just thought I'd ordered 80 Easter eggs, and then the lorry pulls up and we have a lorry full of Easter eggs. I felt pretty stupid pretty quickly.
Mr. David says he has a brilliant customer base at the store who've been buying as many as they can. But he's also launched a raffle to win 100 eggs. He says it will benefit a good cause.
Our long-serving manager at the shop's the president of the Sandy branch of the RNLI. So it's obviously their 200th anniversary at the moment. So in order to kind of celebrate that, all proceeds will go to the RNLI.
The RNLI said it was extremely grateful.
Adam Porter. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
This week on Witness History, we're bringing you fascinating stories from China. And what could be more fascinating than the discovery of China's mysterious terracotta army? 50 years on, we hear from the amazing archaeologists who first dug them up. Plus, the story of a forgotten hero whose invention helped millions of Chinese citizens learn to read and write. And Wham! How one of Britain's biggest pop groups became the first Western act to play in China. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.